Before we started, I wanted to talk a little bit about this nidhyasana in the mornings, what my ideas, and then I've had some talks with Sky, and I've talked about it also. What I'm really hoping for is in this next month that we really can do some real nidhyasana. We'll do some inner child work and things too, but really to be able to do some nidhyasana. I'm really owning myself up and learning really how to be with myself. And that's why I was thinking it would be nice, though. I realize that all of you may do this anyway, and so that you do some yoga, some stretches, whatever, some asanas in the morning right before you come to meditation, instead of trying to do it here, do it on your own, so that your body is, and maybe you all do this, I don't, so I have to start doing it. So this is just for me, maybe. But, you know, if you can do so that you, when you're sitting, that your body has a deep, is capable of a deep relaxation. That's why they do the asanas, so that you can hold your posture without being uncomfortable. And then I wanted, well, so we'll do that instead of trying to do some things in here. It's too, you know, hard. But I did want us to do some that Sky can lead us in, because I'm not able to do that, and I also want to learn it myself. A few pranayamas for maybe 15 minutes, some pranayama. And I want us to do that together, because there's a certain bhava, there's a certain presence, and we, as we get that absorption, that it's nice to kind of do that together, and only for maybe not longer than 15 minutes, and then a half an hour meditation. And then maybe we can start the class at 1:45. So if we have that like 15 minutes or 10 to 15 minutes, Sky can decide. Not more than 15 minutes though. Half an hour of nidhyasana. You know, I might guide it a little bit just to get us started on it. Explain it a little bit. And if you don't need it explained, I'll be talking kind of gently so you can just ignore it. But I'll do a little bit of guidance for a while, and then we'll just do that on our own as we really learn how to do it. So that you can kind of get used to having that level of shanti in your mind and being with your own being. Although that's the idea. I think we have this little time left, so it'd be nice to really have that as something that you're very familiar with. Along with all the inner child work, we want that has to be familiar and kind of second nature, but so is this. So that was my plan, and I think we can at least do that for together. For maybe 3 or 4 days, we'll have to see, and just see what it is like to sink in more, a little bit more deeply into our own presence. Is that okay with everybody?
Yes.
I think if we can do the yoga right before we come here, then that won't be disruptive. Mm-hmm. So, but, okay. All right. Good. I think it's a great idea. It's a good something I think we should do at the course that we spend some time. all right. Please unfold more about how we can understand the two orders of reality. Okay. That's a key word that's been used here. It's an order of reality, not the reality itself. So the realities that we're talking about are Brahman. Brahman is what we call that which is absolutely real. And it's an absolute reality because it's timeless. And that means in reference to past, present, and future, it can never be negated. Actually, because it's timeless. So it can't be negated in past, present, or future. And past, present, and future have to be on, they belong to another order of reality. But Brahman is the presence of that flow of time. And so it is never negated. It's always the non-dual adhishtana, you know, of the passage of time itself. And the passage of time is something that takes place within duality. So Brahman is what we call paramarthika satyam. That is its order of reality. Paramarthika means absolute. Paramarthika satyam, you can say, absolute truth, absolute reality, absolute existence. But what we're talking about is a being that is not bordered by non-being. Anything that changes is bordered by non-being, and so that can't be an absolute being, right? Because that being has to depend upon something else for its being, because nothing can come out of non-being. So that you go into this a regress of, well, this time-bound being depends upon this being. And if this being is also time-bound, so say this time-bound is this big, this long, that depends on a time-bound being that is this much. And this much depends upon a time-bound being that is this much, so that it can come from that. But that can go into an infinite regress. Whereas Brahman is the only thing that simply is. It has no beginning and it has no end. And it has no middle either, in the sense that it is free from time. And so because it's free from time and it is, that existence is absolute because there's no change whatsoever. There's no passage of time from its perspective, from that order of reality. So that is Paramarthika Satyam, absolute being or absolute existence or absolute reality. Now, the next... experience that we have to deal with is this objective universe. This objective universe that we experience. We experience together. We call it a shared vyavaharika. It's called vyavaharika satyam. It's a shared being, a shared existence. It's agreed upon, like we can all agree that we're sitting in here. But this is really Ishvara Srishti, actually. When you say Vyavaharika, it means there's an empirical reality. That's another way we define this world that we experience. It's an empirical reality that we can, you know, subject to science, subject to our inquiry. We can walk out the door and come back in, and the place is still here. Mm-hmm. So it's Ishvara Srishti. It's called Vyavaharika Satyam. It's a shared empirical reality. So it's Ishvara Srishti. Now that's one level. Then there's another level that we call, I haven't told you the order of reality yet, it's called Pratibhasika Satyam. Pratibhasika Satyam is the subjective reality of the jiva. So say, for instance, here I am, this body, mind, sense organs with all of the physical organs and the brain and the physical sense organs. That's all Ishvara. I can't make that come and go. You know, I can't kind of wish it away or let me have a new set of eyes or whatever. It's within shared reality and you're all experiencing it also. And if I were to have an operation or something, the doctors would be experiencing what's there. So it's not Pratibhasika. Pratibhasika means subjective. That means it comes out of my mind. It's a thought or an emotion or what you call an imagination or a projection or even a dream. These are not shared experiences, so they are subjective experiences. Your emotions, your reactions are like that. The things that are going on in your mind, you know, your imaginations, all of these type of things are not shared. Even when there's a projection on something else, like for instance, a projection of a snake on a rope, right? I'm the only one most likely seeing the snake. Everyone else is probably seeing the rope. It's kind of difficult to imagine two of us are having the exact same projection at the same time. It's much more likely that all of us except this one person is seeing the rope, but I happen to have mistaken it for a snake. That snake is subjective. It's there as long as I miss the rope, but it's my subjective reality. When I see the rope, it goes away. And just because I'm seeing the snake doesn't mean that your snake is seeing it. But if the rope is there and that's an objective reality, if you're not seeing the rope, I can say, look, there's a rope there. You're missing it. It's right there. You see it's got three bends. And then you look and say, oh, yeah, I do see that rope. Because it's there to be seen. It's not a projection out of your mind. So we have what we call Vyavaharika Satyam, empirical shared reality, which is also the Ishvara Srishti, Bhagavan's creation. Remember, Srishti means creation. So Ishvara is creation, its whole manifest creation. That's Vyavaharika Satyam. It's empirical reality, shared reality. And then there's what's called Pratibhasika Satyam. That has to do with subjective reality, which is not shared. You know? So what's going on in my mind is not something that you can see. You can guess or, you know, infer, but you can't really experience it directly. These two, empirical reality, the Vyavaharika Satyam, and the subjective reality, Pratibhasika, both of them are mithya. Because whether it be your dream or your imagination or subjective, it still comes into being and goes out of being, and whatever is going on in there is continually changing. So it exists within time and space. The Pratibhasika kind of creates its own space. You know, that's really an interesting thing to understand, that if you have an imagination or a dream, say for instance, the same five elements in a subtle form come. You know, imagine taking an imaginal walk, but there's no space there. Not going to happen. The five elements and the elementals are there on a subtle level and on a physical level. And so, but whether it's the subtle, and time is there in both also. And so both of these, whether it's the empirical reality, shared reality of Ishwar Srishti, or the subjective reality, Pratibhasika Satyam of the Jiva Srishti, both are mithya. Because you cannot establish any independent existence for either one. Because both, everything in it is coming into being and going out of being. Some are going into unmanifest condition, coming into manifest condition. They exist within time and space, both. They're subject to time and space. If they're within space, there's duality. If there's duality, then there's a subject-object relation that's going to be there. Haven't gotten into too much of this yet, but just in a couple of sentences. If there's a subject-object reality, net necessity for something to be known, then that object actually depends upon the knower, right? They're mutually dependent upon each other, in the sense that this can't be known without a knower. And so they're like a unit of two, right? And so if the knower goes away, then this known object can no longer be known. So say you take away the consciousness from this known object. If the consciousness or the conscious means of knowledge or of Ishwara even is not there, then there's no way for this thing to be known. Why? Because it's not self-evident. It's not self-evident. If it's not self-evident, it requires someone with a pramana, with a means of knowledge, to light that up so that it is known. The only way we can say, it's like, you know, if you're in a forest that has, there's no living beings in the forest, just the trees themselves, and the tree falls, is there anybody there to hear it? You've probably heard this before. If the tree falls in a desolate place where there's no living beings, no sense organs, ears around, is that tree heard? And we would say, it's heard by Ishwara, right? Ishwara hears it, but no living beings hearing it. It would be like saying, I don't know quite why I'm bringing it, all I do know. Anyway, it's a little bit off the topic. So now imagine like this to understand Ishwara. Say you're having a dream, and in the dream there's just a forest devoid of any living beings, you know. And in your imaginal forest, a tree falls. Will the tree be heard? Yeah. It'll be heard because it's making a noise, and that noise takes place in the infinite mind of Ishwara, or the infinite upadi of Ishwara, which has sattva throughout. If it has sattva throughout, then whatever takes place in that, in Bhagavan's creation, is known. Like your mind is sattva. When your mind has an imagination, then that is the entire mind. The imagination is taking up, is the changing vritti, as the imagination keeps changing. That imagination is sattva. And so whatever happens in that imagination is not only heard by the characters within the imagination, but it's heard as a sound that exists within the imagination. Anyway, kind of lost myself in that, where I was going with all of that. So anyway, let me just retrace. Vyavaharika Satyam is mithya because Everything within the creation is subject to time and space and vastus that go into infinite regress. You can't find a thing. All of these things that we've been through. So it is mitya. This world, Ishwar Srishti, is mitya. Pratibhasika, my own imaginal world, you know, or projections or whatever, they're also mitya. So you have mitya, mitya, right? Because neither one is real. And in fact, in the Mandukya Upanishad, in chapter 4 especially, they hold up and compare the mityatva, the state of being mitya for the dream, versus the state of being mitya for the waking state. And in that analysis, they say all of the objections, well, how they're different, how the waking state is different from the dream state. But even though they're different, those differences don't touch the mityatva of either one. So Swamiji will sometimes joke and just say that this waking state is kind of a bigger joke than a bigger joke than the dream state, because the dream state doesn't last as long. You know, you can also look at it too as that the dream, these both are mitya, but the mityatva of the dream state is so accessible to you to understand it. And then you don't have to do much to understand that, because it's so experiential to you, right? Where the dream state and the waking state, you are like you're one of the characters in the waking state. And so that's a little harder to have that distance on, and also see the dream state come into being and go out of being, and you're there before, during, and after. So the mityatva is obvious. But if you understand that in the dream, you can start to really grasp it in the waking state. So that's a wonderful thing. So the Brahman is paramarthika satyam, free from time, and so cannot be, the actual definition is for paramarthika satyam, is that which cannot be negated in past, present, and future. But why can't it be negated? Because it's timeless. The vyavaharika satyam, the empirical reality that is also the Ishwar Srishti, is mitya. And the two definitions of mitya, one is, in the Sanskrit, is sadasadbhyam anirvachaniya. That means that which cannot be categorized, anirvachaniya, as sat, paramarthika satyam, absolute reality, or asat, non-existence. And we can say, you know, it, in a sense, it's non-existent because it has no existence of its own, but we experience it. And since, so you can't say it's asat only because you experience it. But you also can't say it's sat because it comes into being and goes out of being. The other definition, so that's one, that's a major definition of mitya. Another definition of mitya is that anything mitya requires an adhishtana. The word mitya itself presupposes that there's an adhishtana. The adhishtana is always the thing, whatever that may be, that whatever is classified as mitya depends upon. So the stock example, you know, is a clay pot. So the pot is mitya because it has no independent being. It totally 100% depends upon the clay for its being. Rope snake, another stock example. The snake depends totally on the rope, bends, diameter, length, everything. Depends totally on the rope for its being. If you were to move the rope, then the snake is gone. 100% dependence on what we call the adhishtana. So you can't even use the word mitya with any sense of knowledge unless you understand and recognize the adhishtana upon which it depends. So for instance, I can't say, oh, this whole universe is mitya, with any type of knowledge or understanding unless I've recognized the adhishtana. Otherwise, I would have to say the Vedanta says that that this world is mitya, and I've been taught that anything mitya depends upon an adhishtana. But for you to say that this world is mitya because of your own knowledge is because you recognize what is satyam. You know, and in our drishtantas, the illustrations, that's very easy. I mean, we've got the rope snake, the clay pot, and Swamiji's, you know, wooden desk. And also the wave ocean. That wave ocean is mitya. And you can see the water. The adhishtana is there clear, you know. So in all of our drishtantas, it's very obvious, the satya mitya relationship. It is not so obvious in reference to this world, my body, mind, sense organs, anything that can be objectified, is to say all of this is mitya. To be able to really say that, you have to recognize that I, my own being, which is not objectifiable, is the adhishtana, and how that is possible. You have to be able to recognize that. And then the mityatva of the world is shining, but you need to recognize what its adhishtana is. The examples are so important, like clay pot, the clay pot or the wooden desk or whatever. The problem with them is that it's so clear in just round one. Like you have the pot, clay pot example, and then this pot is dependent upon the clay, so this is mitya, the clay is satyam. But of course the clay is not satyam. Mm. It's only good for a drishtanta to show the relationship between the name and form and the substance. That's all it's good for. Because then you have to say, okay, well now this clay is satyam and there's the satyam, you know, the satyam wood. But those things aren't satyam. They're only good for the example. Those things will also go into an infinite regress of divisibility, and you know, the vastu is divided infinitely into smaller things, and the wood itself will disintegrate, and of course the clay will go back to dust, and the wood will go back to its fragments and whatnot. You know, so they're not, certainly not satyam, but they're not supposed to be satyam. There's only one thing that is satyam, paramarthikas, and that is Brahman. So what needs to be really carefully and understood and taken for granted in a way, that every drishtanta or illustration that we use is bordered, you know. It's only it because it's not the same as the actual vastu. It's the actual thing that we're talking about. That's called the darshtanta. And so you can't take it beyond this one kind of level. If we do take it beyond, then the clay goes into shards, and the shards goes into dust, and the dust goes into molecules, and it's just as mitya as everything else. Yeah. So the use of the drishtantas are very powerful, but you have to keep them boxed in. They're only good for so far, right? And that's always going to be the case, right? Because there's only one Brahman, and Brahman's not an object in the creation. And so every drishtanta is flawed if you push it too far. And so that's important to realize.
I'm a little bit confused about the trees.
About what?
The trees. When you were explaining, like, in the dream, mm-hmm. For the dreamer, it's known that the trees fall. Mm-hmm. That is heard.
Yeah.
But for I was confused. I didn't hear for Ishvara if...
Do the same.
But...
Why not?
Well, so Ishvara is... Then it must be a hearer and...
No, it doesn't need hearing because the whole upadi...
Is reflecting.
Yeah, the entire upadi reflects everything. So you don't need... Ishvara doesn't need sense organs. He doesn't need organs of action or anything.
But it's just... Still, why do we say it's heard?
Well, as opposed to not being heard. Let's not say heard. The sound is.
The sound is. Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's good. That's a good point. Yeah. I don't even know I brought that up. Some roundabout way got there. Yeah. You never know what's going to happen. Yeah. What is it that makes Brahman into an intelligent consciousness and just not a consciousness? Like when we do puja and wish and ask for help and send prayers. Yeah, good question. We say that Brahman is the nimitta upadana karanam. Okay? Upadana karanam means the material cause. And then we add another word if we're talking about the material cause, vivarta upadana karanam. That means that as the material cause of this creation, the sat chit atma, the sat chit brahman, is the material cause of this creation, and being vivarta, this word, it means that it goes through no change to become the creation. It's not like Brahman is conscious being and now it kind of modifies, conscious being modifies into the creation. No, it's vivarta. Conscious being is non-dual. It goes through no change at all. And so now the question is, how can we say that it's intelligent? So now what we have to bring in the nimitta upadana karanam. Upadana karanam is the material cause. The nimitta is the efficient cause. So you, when you bring in the nimitta karanam, you're bringing in Ishvara. Because so then Brahman, which, I mean, Ishvara really is only Brahman, because Brahman is the adhishtana and Ishvara is mitya. Right? And so we can say Brahman is the nimitta upadana karanam, but to be the efficient nimitta, to be the efficient cause, that is where infinite intelligence, or the, when we talk about the manifestation of infinite knowledge, we're talking about Ishvara. Brahman with the Maya Upadi becomes the manifestation of infinite knowledge. So Swamiji uses this term, the manifestation of infinite knowledge for the creation, because it underscores the fact that the whole creation is known. And so say, for instance, we say for Ishvara, in the manifestation of infinite knowledge, where for the jiva, it's the manifestation of limited knowledge. And so say, any vritti that you have, or even I can, or what Swamiji used to, just say a number of words like pot, sky, daisy, forest, flower, lucky, whatever, bum, 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 bum. And every word that says brings a manifestation of the rupa for you. That's how it works. Like I can't say, what if I say forest? You can't stop yourself from that image coming forth. You just will. Now, what if I say, okay, I'm going to say a word. Don't let the image come. Don't let the image come. So I say the word, but the image is there as immediately as it's said. And so the relationship between nama rupa, you know, is really the manifestation of knowledge. It's the word that manifests this knowledge. So this creation we look at as the whole maya in unmanifest condition, unmanifest knowledge, comes into infinite unmanifest knowledge becomes infinite manifest knowledge. So when it's manifest, then it is known. Manifest knowledge is known. And so the creation as is then infinite intelligence, because there's nothing actually that's not known. There's no shakti outside of it, so it's limitless shakti. So absolutely everything that is here in this creation is a manifestation, is manifest knowledge. You know, and so that's how we talk about intelligence, and that manifest knowledge enjoys conscious being as the adhishtana. So it's called the nimitta upadana karana. Now we say that for Brahman, and just another little aside, Brahman is the vivarta upadana karana as the material cause. It's just sat chit ananda, conscious, pure consciousness. Then we say that Maya is the material cause. It's called for the manifestation of for the infinite manifestation of knowledge. And what is Maya? Is called the parinama upadana karanam. The upadana karanam, material cause, is parinama. Means it's what is responsible for, it's that material cause modifies itself, sattva rajas tamas, modifies itself in the projection of the universe. It goes through, you know, an infinite modification to become this universe. And that modification is the manifestation of infinite knowledge. That is, goes from the unmanifest. Like, just think for you right now. Just think of everything that you've ever known or known, and that's kind of stored in your psyche, were manifest right now. The minuscule amount of experience that is manifest now, it's so minuscule compared to the totality of your experience. But what is manifest right now for you is what needs to be experienced right now. But when we talk about for Ishvara, with an infinite creation, there's an infinite manifestation of knowledge. But the main point I was trying to make is for you to recognize that you have a lot of knowledge right now that is unmanifest, even in this waking state. It's unmanifest, but it's there. Like if I ask you to think about something, like, you know, what car were you driving last year? That's stuck down in there. So, you know, all these things are there. Yeah, but they're not useful. They're not up right now, but that doesn't mean they're not there. So think of the infinite, unmanifest creation that comes into manifestation as it does. Does that make sense? So that's the efficient, what we mean by the nimitta, efficient cause, intelligent. I often find myself being disappointed in human beings, especially now. Seems like I have too high expectations. Can you say something about the psychology behind that feeling? For example, I am rather by myself. I am rather by myself company to spend time with people that disappoint me. Can't read that word. I do not know if I then escape my disappointment by being alone or if I just prefer being alone. What disappoints me can be a dharma or two rajasic people. You know, you can kind of change your attitude and the way that you respond to people. I kind of learned this from Swamiji in kind of similar conversations I had, you know, decades ago. But to be interested in people, you know, rather than judging people, to be interested in them. And if they have some problem or issue, to be more interested in what's causing that, you know, realizing that whatever that they are at this time is really an effect in this kind of chain of cause effect. And actually that, not that I do that all the time, but I think that is helpful. And it stops you from getting into a kind of a judgmental space with other people if you're more interested in them than wondering why they're a good person or a bad person or dharmic or adharmic, especially if you go back in time. In terms of, you imagine if you know anything about that person or about their past or what they've been through to bring them to this point, then you get a much, much better understanding of them and you're more interested in them than in being judgmental of them. And that gives a lot of inner peace and inner space. And you know, when we have situations like in the world now, there's some really things that require a lot of patience and a lot of understanding, because there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of damage that's being done. But you can still be more interested and interested in what's created that situation. And also, if you think of it in terms of Ishvara, we kind of are all getting what we deserve, in the sense that we're all born here together at this time. Everybody that's born here in this creation, in this loka, we're all here together, right? And this is our collective prarabdha. You know, and it's a pretty tough one. I mean, we're exhausting certain kinds of karma now, because here we are in Kali Yuga. We're at least a quarter, a little more into it. And so we don't get to, in this particular lifetime, we don't get to enjoy kind of the safety and the security and the shanti that comes when the environment is predominantly dharmic. You know, because there's a real security in that, because people are contained within Dharma, and that means that the social expression is much truer to Ishvara. So since everybody's Ishvara, you know, it's much easier to relax and feel at home than in a society that is a quarter of the way through Kali Yuga, and the cow of Dharma is on one leg. So the goodness, that goodness has to be your value system. You have to contain that goodness and Dharma for your own well-being. And what is the way that people that aren't in a great deal of pain are, you know. But we don't get to enjoy being held by Dharma. You know what I mean? We, from the outside, not necessarily. It's very one-legged. So I guess it's just a matter of attitude, you know. I think I've told you before, in one of these times we've been together, that I used to have a problem with justice. You know, and I would think of it like this: if somebody does something really bad to you, by any stretch, just accept it. Somebody has done something that's really mean and really, really hurtful. The natural, what you would want to do is kind of give that back, you know, like push back on it in some way. But if you do that, did this person say done, in objectively speaking, so I mean it can be projections and all that, I'm just getting rid of all that just for the sake of this example. So say something, the person has done something really bad, really adharmic, has really hurt you, has really caused a lot of pain, and then you give back in kind. Then Bhagavan doesn't say, well, he deserved it, you know. He deserved it. So you're fine, give it back. No, that's not what you get at all. You get your own adharmic punishment for doing that adharmic act, no matter what was done to you. And so, I don't know, I don't remember the details, but I remember that it used to really bug me. It used to, it used to make me mad, kind of, you know. And then it's at some point I understood it. Of course it's that way. Just because somebody's adharmic doesn't mean that you can go be adharmic back to them, you know, and Bhagavan's just saying, oh, well, you know, a dharma, what a dharma for a dharma, you know. It's not a dharma for a dharma, you know. If you do a dharma, you'll be punished. If you do a dharma, you'll be punished, no problem. And so there's no escape. You have to own the dharma. Just like there's no escape from knowledge, you have to own the fact of it. You have to own your knowledge. That's what it is. And it's a beautiful thing, actually. And I don't remember all of the story around why it was a problem for me, but I do remember that it really was, and it used to really make me mad. It used to irritate me until I understood. Now it seems so simple, but at that time it wasn't. So I saw Swamiji deal with very difficult people, and I don't think he thought about them in terms of, or me or any of us, in terms of dharma and adharma or goodness or badness. It was just more a very deep, penetrating understanding. You're seeing levels beyond what was just being manifest right now, you know. And that, there's something beautiful in that too, because he would always give the benefit of the doubt, you know. It's like seeing, like one time, not just a little bit different than what we're talking about right now, but one time he used as an example, and he used it in a conversation I was having with him personally, but he's used it in class also. Just imagine a sculptor like a Michelangelo or something, who there's a big piece of marble. They're a big rectangle of beautiful marble. And then that Michelangelo will chip away at all of the things that don't belong there, you know, leaving this beautiful, you know, statue, whatever the beautiful works he's done. And so Swamiji was saying that he kind of sees it like that. He sees the beautiful person, you know, and then he helps the chip off the the little things that don't belong there. You know? Mm-hmm. But who he sees is who you really are, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a beautiful example. Mm-hmm. So that's an example to kind of hold in your mind and try to be that way, become that way as you, in your own time. In today's class, you talked about that the personal me is me. Isn't that only 50% right? Yeah. No, that's not right. Okay. So in today's class, you talked about that the personal me is me. Isn't that only 50% right? I got a little confused. Okay. The me that you take yourself to be right now in terms of this conscious being that you are, right, that's personal, right? But we tend to think that what makes consciousness, conscious me, personal is the upadis. It's I can even, I'll just make up this language, but I think it's right. Like this me, when seen through the upadi, like this me seen through your mind, and your mind and your sense organs and your buddhi and your unconscious and the physical body kind of personalizes that me. As though the me experience is personalized or contributed to by the body, mind, sense organs, the unique body, mind, sense organs that you are, the unique set of experiences, the unique everything, you know. That somehow individualizes your sense of me. And so that's why you would say that's 50% correct, because it's through this body, mind, sense organs that I'm experiencing myself, and myself is somehow contributing to the self-experience. And that is exactly what is not true. That's exactly what is not true. Because the totality of what you experience as me is exactly the same as when this body, mind, sense organs drops off. If you can imagine that. It drops, say, it completely drops off, like for a liberated person, it completely drops off. Or say if we look at the dream state, where in the dream state you're totally identified with this character and you're doing all kinds of things, you have relationships, and you are what you are. But when the dream, you wake up from the dream, the me of that character, nothing has happened to it. And it is me, the very me that is here right now. And so the me that you take yourself to be and consider to be personal, because after you may be Brahman, but you are in this form now. But this form doesn't really exist. It doesn't have any being whatsoever. The being that fills this form is Brahman, is myself. And so, you know, you can have things that you hear and things that you see and all of these things, but the me, the self, is exactly the same. Nothing is influencing it or touching it or coloring it, you know, or like putting an emotional bag over it. That's impossible. And so the me experience that you think is being contributed to by these upadis is not being contributed by these upadis. So the me experience that you experience now is this body-mind sense organs is exactly the me that all beings experience and that you experience as you transmigrate and leave the body behind or whatever, in nirvikalpa samadhi. It's exactly the same me that is the me here. So that's one of those big, beautiful aha moments, is to recognize that what makes you you has nothing to do with your body, mind, sense organs. It has only to do with you, with the conscious being that you are. And then this conscious being that is me, non-dual me, there's only one. There's only one such me, and that is me. Not any of you, of course, just me. It's only one. So your sense, your me, is my me, is your me, not twins. There's only one me. You know, and many minds and many bodies, many sense organs, many experiences in all infinite, it's almost like a hologram, you know, it's just infinite sets of experiences, but only one me. And that the me is not having any experiences. It is just the conscious being because of which all experiences are. And those all those experiences are known because they're there. It's not like you say, oh no, the self is not having any experiences. From its own standpoint, no. But from the standpoint of its Maya, all of these things are reflected. And as long as they're there, they have an experience. As long as you have a mind, the mind is experienced. Right? As long as you have sense organs, those vrittis are experienced. For Ishwara, as long as the universe is up, the universe is experienced. There no knower is necessary because consciousness itself is the self-evident knownness which all of these experiences enjoy. That's why you can, in meditation, sometimes it's good to just sit with yourself and ask yourself, is there all whatever vritti I have, whatever experience I have, it is known. Because it's there, it's known. And yes, is there a knower? Is there an experience of a knower? And you have to say, no, there isn't. Everything is known. And so therefore we construct a knower. But there is no such experience. So that's very nice too, because you don't miss it. You don't say, there's no knower. You say, there never has been a knower. Everything has always been known, and it's always and everything is known because of me, because I'm self-evident me, conscious being. And so anything that comes in my wake, so to speak, any vritti that comes up, of course it is known. The vritti's not there, I am known. Not as an object, no subject-object, it's just because I'm self-evident. And so the world enjoys self-evident me, which we call in our language as known. But the Ahankara has made this knower-known differentiation from that distinguishes conscious me from objects that I don't identify with as me. So I am the knower, and then this is the known. And if I, especially if I have a means of knowledge like my eyes, I'm the seer, and this is the seen, and this is the pramana for seeing, all of this kind of stuff. We talk it like this, but it doesn't match your experience. We don't think about it, so we don't notice that fact, but it doesn't, you know, what your experience is what is here is known, whatever it is. Whatever vritti is there, it is known. So you have to, it's a good meditation to see, okay, is there? You say, no, there's no nor. But everything is known because of self-evident consciousness. So, one more. Can you explain more about sattva being reflected in conscious being? How about conscious being reflected in sattva? Explain what sattva means and why it is reflected more comparing to rajas and tamas. Well, if maya is broken into three parts, in other words, if we define maya, okay? First of all, maya is mitya. It has no independent existence at all. But we say maya is comprised of three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And that's what maya is. There's no other maya. And then these three gunas are stuck on it. You know, like they're attributes of a substance. They're not attributes of a substance called maya. Maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas. So in this particular model, we see in terms of the, from just standing at this vantage point, we can divide the creation, our experience, the totality of our experience in the creation, into these three very broad categories. And one of those categories is sattva. Sattva is that which allows for the manifestation of consciousness, where you can identify something as sattva because of its enjoyment of consciousness. Like, for instance, the mind. The mind is known. It enjoys consciousness. The sense organs are known, right? They enjoy, they reflect consciousness. They're sattva. So sattva is anything that seems to manifest consciousness. Then you'll say, well, the body enjoys consciousness and it's tamas, it's inert. A dead body, after all, is just inert and it goes back into its elements, the prana leaves and the body's dead, the prana, the rajas goes, and you're just left with a carcass, basically. But because of the sense of touch, which is sattva, the sense organs are sattva, the sense of touch pervades the body, so because of that, the body enjoys consciousness. So of these three elements, sattva, rajas, and tamas, the sattva is that which manifests or reflects consciousness that will account for all your mind and sense organs, basically. In this, for all the jivas, it would be the mind and sense organ. For Ishvara, it's the knownness of the infinite Maya Upadhi because sattva pervades it. Then we can say the second, so this is one broad component that allows also for this knower known phenomena that involves your sense organs and your mind versus their objects of knowledge. Right? And so we get this, because of the sattva, we have this subject-object relationship within the creation. Then rajas is the activity principle. And the rajas, in terms of my body, would be, a physical body, would be the prana, the five pranas that are enlivening the body, and the karmendriyas that allow the body to work. So in terms of the physical body, the rajas is the prana, and the karmendriyas, the five organs of action. And in reference to the creation, to the total, it is all of the energy that is going on in the creation to keep, you know, all the planets going around the, are going around the sun, and all of the seasons, and all of the continual, on every level, there's continual manifestation of energy, of change, you know. Nothing is still. And so change requires energy, and that energy is rajas, you know. So this is just, we can use rajas and rajas, he's a very rajasic person. We can use it as a guna for the mind or the body like that. So rajasic means he has a lot of energy, he can be quickly irritated. You know, if you can read in like this chapter 15, 16 and 17 in the Gita where they're going over, and in chapter 14 also, they're going over all these, using these terms as gunas, as qualities for you, you know. What a rajasic person. Well, they have so much energy, but they're so short-tempered and irritable. And, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, she's such a beautifully sattvic person. So gentle, so peaceful. I love to be around her because she's so calm and beautiful. She's ananda flowing out of her. Very sattvic. Devata. Yeah. Tamas, poor fellow. So you can use all of this. You can use these things as good as. Okay, so rajas is the active principle, and tamas is what allows for the sense of materiality, like material, like this is all tamas, you know. It's what's responsible for nama rupa, for that solidity. And that tamas, even in your dreams, you can see. There's sattva, rajas, and tamas. That's the material of maya. So even if it's coming as, on a subtle level, in your dream, there's still sattva, rajas, and tamas. And in the dream, you can, you know, if you say the dream character were to say something like, people are accusing this of being a dream. How could it possibly be a dream? Look at, if I pinch myself, it hurts. If I try to lift this up, it's really heavy. What do you mean it's a dream? It's not a dream. This is real. This is real. We do the same thing. This is real. All of these. So anyway, sattva, rajas, and tamas is responsible for the manifestation of three major categories of what we experience in the world. And when you put these things together, it accounts not only for the world that we experience, that we objectify, it also includes the knower, right? The knower means within, just within our language, within this empirical reality, the sense organs and with the mind, I become the knower. So there's the knower-known relationship within duality. So that's the beautiful thing about it. It includes the jiva. You know, this model includes of sattva, rajas, and tamas, includes the jiva, and it includes Brahman also. Because the sense of consciousness is in within the creation is caused by sattva. You know, Brahman can be adhishtana, the non-dual adhishtana of the entire creation. But how can that be? how can conscious being be the adhishtana of the entire creation when we've got the floor? The floor is just set. It's not chit. It's not set chit. So there's this kind of confusion. But I'm set chit. You're set chit. The floor is not set chit. Actually, it is set chit because the floor is known, but it's not set chit from its own standpoint. The floor can't talk, that type of thing. And so there's this disparity between the inert and the conscious in the creation. So if you say that Brahman is the truth, the adhishtana of the whole thing, why doesn't everything enjoy consciousness? You know? Well, because some things don't have a sukshma sharira, that's why. You know? That's one answer from the standpoint of the upadhi itself manifesting consciousness to be able to say, I am a conscious being and the floor can't do that. So that becomes very helpful in understanding the sattva rajas tamas as responsible for this manifestation, all of which exists in consciousness. And then you can go further with it and say, all the things that have a sukshma sharira reflect consciousness or manifest consciousness, and all the things that don't, they enjoy the sat, they don't from their own standpoint enjoy the chit, but all of them are known. And the knownness is just self-evident consciousness. And then, in fact, we can look at your knowership also. The knowership really is just the reflection of consciousness in a mirror, in the mirror of sattva, like that. So, anyway, that's the beautiful thing about this. I don't know if I answered it or not. Let's see. So there's a confusion here. Can you explain more about sattva being reflected in conscious being? You would say, can you explain more about conscious being reflected in sattva? Okay. Not the opposite. Sattva isn't reflected in conscious beings. Conscious being is reflected in sattva, if that makes sense. Explain what sattva means and why it is reflected more compared to rajas and tamas. Well, because of these three gunas, each one is completely different, really. The sattva guna is what reflects consciousness. The rajas guna is all just about activity and energy. The tamas guna is about nama-rupa, matter. And so they have their three different shaktis, in a way. You know, they have different jobs. And so each one is unique to itself, and the three together are what we call maya. And they're never apart, actually. I mean, they're always intertwined with each other in one way or another.
Om swasti pajabhyah paripalayantam yayena margena mahimahishah ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve padrani pasyantu, ma kaschitu kabhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat, Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.